Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As tends to happen when the White House schedules a major speech, the healthcare debate has largely stalled this week. The president goes before Congress next Wednesday night to talk healthcare. What he might say and how it might matter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 3rd of September. Good to have you here. The White House insists the president still favors a public option, some kind of government-run insurance program. But give and take is part of the political process, and there are reports that that option may be up for negotiation. To help figure out what that and the rest of the debate might actually mean, we've called Mark McClellan. He's the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. He's an MD and an economics PhD. Welcome to the program.
Kai, good to be with you.
How much would it matter if next Wednesday night the president does do away with this public insurance option? In the grand scheme of healthcare reform, what does that mean?
It would help bring Republicans on board, Kai, and I don't think it's absolutely essential for getting healthcare spending growth down. There are many other ways to do that. So it could be a way to get Republicans on board. I'm not sure it's enough to do it by itself. But it could be an important step towards a bipartisan approach for healthcare reform.
Does it make this discussion about healthcare reform, though, more into health insurance reform somehow?
I believe this has got to be part of healthcare reform. It can't just be about expanding health insurance and changing insurance market rules. We've got to make it easier for doctors, patients, for other health professionals to take the steps that are necessary to prevent complications, to keep people well, and to avoid unnecessary healthcare costs. In so many ways, the healthcare payment systems we have in place today don't make it easy for people to get the best care at the lowest cost. So that's got to change too.
You know, you mentioned this a moment ago, the idea that the Obama administration has to curb healthcare spending, the growth in healthcare spending. Did they make a political tactical error when they made cost cutting sort of the centerpiece of their plan, of their proposal?
A lot of Americans are understandably concerned, given the complexity of the whole healthcare debate, that steps to lower healthcare costs could result in reductions in access to care. And that's why I think it's so important to frame any discussion about healthcare cost savings around the fact that there are plenty of opportunities in our healthcare system to reduce costs while actually improving quality of care.
How much of the political problem that the president faces in this debate is because those of us who have health insurance, generally speaking, are reasonably happy with it, and we just don't see what's in it for us to pay $1 trillion for reform?
I think a lot of people are not only reasonably happy with their current coverage and their doctor, but also understandably worried about healthcare reform changes. What needs more attention is the fact that the kinds of healthcare plans and kinds of access to providers that people have today is really threatened if we don't do reform the right way. Healthcare costs have been rising. Many employers have been dropping or cutting back on coverage. If we stay on this track, the coverage that you have now is just not going to be there.
Let me pick up on that last point. Is incremental change acceptable at this point?
I think incremental changes that add up to more fundamental reforms over time, Kai, is probably the only way to go. I don't think Americans are comfortable with radical changes in the healthcare system. I do think that many of the steps that we've been talking about, like doing a better job of supporting doctors and patients when they take steps to lower costs, like giving people better information on quality of care and paying more for better care, those steps can be implemented gradually and in a way that adds up to big savings over time.
Dr. Mark McClellan runs the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. He ran the FDA and the Office for Medicare and Medicaid Services in the Bush White House. He was in the Clinton administration, too. Dr. McClellan, thanks a lot for your time.
Great talking with you, Kai.
From healthcare to finance now, the ratings agencies have been on the receiving end of much criticism for their role in fostering the credit crisis, giving AAA ratings to B-grade bonds. Those companies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's specifically, have long used the First Amendment as a defense against lawsuits, that they've got a constitutional right to say what they want, even if it costs people money. This week, a federal judge threw out that defense, which means a lawsuit claiming the companies intentionally inflated their ratings on risky mortgages can indeed proceed. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The First Amendment has never been an absolute defense. So says Yale law professor Jonathan Macy, who points out it's not okay to yell fire in a packed theater.
They've been saying there's no fire in the crowded theater that's our financial markets when there has been a fire, and taking money for saying that there's no fire.
Until now, Macy says the free speech defense has left victims with no way out.
We get to say whatever we want, but unless we were knowingly lying, unless you can prove that we were knowingly lying, you don't get to have your day in court with us.
Now, securities law attorney Tom Ajami says it'll be up to the investors to prove fraud. Not just that the ratings turned out to be wrong, but that the agencies knew it to begin with.
It's a very high burden, but one way to show that may be internal memos where they said among themselves, these are risky, but then went ahead and gave very high, safe ratings.
This ruling applies only to cases in which ratings are specifically offered to a select group of investors. But Yale's Jonathan Macy argues that not extending it to everyone now wouldn't be fair.
Big sort of institutional investor fat cats get to sue credit rating agencies because they're the ones who purchase in these elite private placements, whereas the great unwashed don't get to sue because they don't get to participate in these private placements. I think that is wacky.
We placed a call to Floyd Abrams, who represents Standard & Poor's and is a leading attorney on First Amendment issues. He did not call back by airtime. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Duke Energy is the third largest electricity company in the country. And as of today, it is no longer part of a group called the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. It's a lobbying group aimed at greening up the image of coal-fired power plants that use new technology to cut down on greenhouse gases. But Duke says the group is aimed at something else, too, blocking climate change legislation. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains Duke's change of heart.
It's not like Duke opposes clean coal. It's just that Duke also wants the government to enact a climate bill that would cap carbon emissions. And that's where the energy giant parts ways with the Clean Coal Coalition, says spokesman Tim Williams.
And it's become increasingly clear since the climate bill passed the House that there were some very influential members who would not support climate change legislation, no matter how it was written.
Amanda Rosen is a political scientist at Webster University. She says many energy companies think a crackdown on carbon is inevitable, so they might as well get on board.
Rather than opposing any action, it's better to be on the other side of the equation, working with the legislation and tweaking it so that it helps them as much as possible.
In Duke's case, that means influencing how new legislation will treat investments in clean energy, how it will value reductions in carbon emissions.
We're building the world's largest coal gasification plant. We're pursuing two nuclear stations that would dramatically reduce our carbon emissions. But again, those are $12 billion investments, and we really need to get the regulatory framework set on climate before we make those investments.
Williams says by leaving the Clean Coal Coalition, Duke believes it can get a final climate bill that will be easier for businesses to afford. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, this was a rare three-way up day for the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. College students and their parents who have yet to write this fall's tuition checks may want to bear the following statistic in mind. According to the Department of Education, more students are going deeper into debt to pay for school. Last year, total federal student loan payments increased 25%. Are students getting what they borrowed for? Commentator Tyler Cowen says, yeah, they are, sort of.
There's lots of evidence that placebos work in medicine. People get well simply because they think they're supposed to. But we're learning that placebos apply to a lot of other areas, and that includes higher education. Schooling works in large part because it makes people feel they've been transformed. Think about it. College graduates earn a lot more than non-graduates, but studying Walt Whitman rarely gets people a job. In reality, the students are jumping through lots of hoops and acquiring a new self-identity. The educators and the administrators stage a kind of theater to convince students that they now belong to an elite group of higher earners. If students believe this story, many of them will then live it. Colleges, therefore, are very concerned with prestige, status, and yes, pretense. That means thick syllabi, famous professors, and an impressive graduation ceremony. Online instruction will never take over from traditional colleges and universities. Just as missionaries make personal visits to bring their message to life, so must professors and students spend FaceTime together to animate the feeling that learning is taking place. One reason we spend so much on college is to convince ourselves of our own commitment. Similarly, in medicine, experiments show that aspirin relieves more of our pain if we know we spent more money on the pills. In the armed forces, part of making Marines is that the soldiers feel they suffered to get there. So effective higher education probably won't ever be cheap or easy. It really does cost a lot to bundle together a bit of learning, some good theater, and some missionary zeal, replete with the socially required props. Colleges and universities may appear inefficient or overpriced, but it's a business model likely to stand the test of time. As long as we keep on thinking that it works, it probably does.
Tyler Cowen is what you might call an interested party in the success of higher education. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University. There's more on this in his latest book, Create Your Own Economy, The Path to Prosperity in a Disordered World. We want to hear from you, orderly or dis. Write to us at marketplace.org. There are dozens of issues underlying the often tense relationship between Israelis and Palestinians. Many of them are incredibly complicated, like land use, security arrangements, and settlement rights. All of those play a role in the region's economic development. And then there's water. Michael May reports from the West Bank.
In the West Bank village of Kudawat Ben Issaid, some two dozen people line up at a water tanker parked on the main street. Back in April, faucets in the village went dry. Many homes haven't had water since. One resident, Fahed Obed, says water from the tankers costs three times as much as tap water.
I need not less than 600 shekels every month for water. And my salary, not more than 1,400 Israeli shekels. What can I do?
But today in Kudawat Ben Issaid, the mood is festive. These tankers are distributing free water, provided by a coalition of Israeli and Palestinian nonprofit agencies. Children jump about to music blaring from loudspeakers and dance in the spray. It's a rare moment of solidarity between Israelis and Palestinians. But Palestinians are very frustrated. According to the World Bank, Israelis get four times as much water per capita as the Palestinians. This village sits on top of a huge mountain aquifer, but like 45% of the people in the West Bank, residents have to get their water through the Israeli water company, Mekarot. Sali Rabi is with the Palestinian Water Training Institute.
If we could not have full control over our water resources, we could not establish our Palestinian state. Because without water, you could not build your economy, you could not build your industry and agriculture, and we could not have any refugees who could come back.
In 1993, the Israelis and Palestinians came to an agreement. The Palestinians were guaranteed a certain amount of water, and the two sides set up a joint water committee. But a recent study by the World Bank says the committee has stymied development by giving Israel veto power over Palestinian water projects. And it says the Palestinian Authority has made matters worse by letting sewage run untreated into the groundwater. Gidon Bromberg is the director of Israel's Friends of the Earth. He says both sides are at fault.
The Israeli side, by not understanding that more water to Palestine means a greater commitment for those shared water resources, and a lack of understanding from the Palestinian side that short-term thinking, failure to treat sewage, in the end harms Palestine as well.
Israeli Olin Tal, a researcher at Ben-Gurion University, and Palestinian Alfred Abed Rabo, a chemist at Bethlehem University, are writing a book together about possible solutions to the water conflict. Abed Rabo says a number of small Israeli and Palestinian cities along the border are already collaborating.
Emek Hefer and Tulkarem, for example, they are trying to solve a problem of the sewage that goes into the Alexander River because it touches both of them. Environment has no boundary, as we always say.
Olin Tal says water shortages could become a thing of the past. Israel has been investing heavily in desalination plants along its coast.
That bottle of water we're drinking right now on the table, I don't know what we'll end up paying for, but it's probably a dollar and a half for a liter of water. Here we can make 1,000 liters of water for a little more than 50 cents. So when all of a sudden you have this ability to produce more water, then we can talk about these things more dispassionately. We can maybe be a little bit more creative by expanding the pile together.
Tal and Abed Rabo say it's hard to overstate the importance of solving the water problem. A resolution would let Palestinian agriculture thrive and so grow the West Bank's economy. Israel would benefit from greater peace and stability in the region, and both sides could demonstrate that they can successfully work together.
I'm Michael May for Marketplace.
Coming up, let's go to the videotape.
It is harder to lie on video. If I'm a recruiter, I would almost think that I'm finding out more about who the real person is than what their lies are going to be on the resume.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tacked on 0.6%. Today's 63 points closed at 9,344. The NASDAQ bumped up 0.8%. That's 16 points, finished at 1983. The S&P 500 also added 0.8%, 8 points there, rounded out the day at 1,003. Financial shares helped break the Dow's four-day losing streak. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank just over 3%. Bank of America deposited 3.5%. Citigroup brought home an extra 4.5%. Today, Morgan Stanley ended the session up 2%. August retail sales were better than expected, and you know what that means. Nordstrom toted up nearly 9%. Macy's and JCPenney joined the spree, each getting 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.35%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Labor Department reports on unemployment for August. Finance officials are in London for a meeting of the world's top 20 economies. The G20 meets again for a summit in Pittsburgh later this month. And September 4th, 1957 was E-Day, E for Edsel. That's when Ford Motor Company unveiled its new car. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. For a lot of the 1990s, the global economy was a pretty dynamic place, and no place was more dynamic than Ireland. You remember the Celtic Tiger? Low taxes made Ireland attractive for everything from high tech to construction. And there was so much work, and it paid so well, that Irish who'd come to the U.S. went back across the water, as they say. But Ireland has been hammered harder than most in this recession. Yesterday, the government there released its August unemployment report. Nearly 12.5% of the population is out of work. That's the highest in 14 years. And it explains why many of those who went home are coming back here again. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports from New York.
If you're Irish in New York and you need help, the guy to call is Mickey McCreesh.
I'd say every day it's probably two or three calls every day.
McCreesh knows people. He owns a night spot in Queens called Bar 43, and during the day he works at his brother's construction company. He says the people who call him are looking for whatever jobs they can get, in construction, bars, babysitting.
It's got very bad at home. There's not a whole lot of work there.
The Irish have been escaping to America for generations. What's different this time is that a lot of the people he's hearing from have been here before.
We're here originally to live the American dream, and then things were good at home. You know, people were better paid at home than they were here. Since it started to die down, I've seen quite a few old faces coming back, and just all their stories are that they couldn't find work at home.
That's what happened to Gemma and Kevin Dunn. I talked to her today while she watched their kids at home in Woodlawn, an Irish neighborhood in the Bronx. The couple met in New York in the late 90s. She was waitressing, he was working construction. They got married and had a little boy. In 2005, they decided to go back to Ireland.
We wanted to come, build a home, and like make a career out of it. Kevin was building and selling, and it was great at the time, like.
Until the economy started coming apart.
And then work got so bad that he was out of work, and there was nothing he could do. Like, there was no money he could get or anything. So we decided to move back.
This past June, her family helped them pay for the move.
Oh, it was heartbreaking, because I'm from a family of 21, and we were living with them all up in the same town. So it killed me leaving all them behind. You know, where all the new babies been born. And
now that they're back, she says it feels like they never left. A lot of friends are still here, and a lot are following them back from Ireland, too. Her husband found a job working construction in the city, but a lot of Irish haven't been so lucky. That's what's different about this emigration. Things might be bad in Ireland, but usually there's work to be found in other countries. Paul Finnegan works at the New York Irish Centre, a community organization that helps new immigrants.
They've also been traveling to Australia, and they've been traveling all over the world, as always. And what's very bleak about these times is that it's not like Ireland is suffering. There's other opportunities elsewhere.
He says it can be hard to find a job in New York, too. And like Mickey McCreesh, Finnegan gets calls and emails every day asking about prospects for work here. He tells them they might want to tough it out in Ireland a little longer before they get on a plane. Gemma Dunn says she and her husband didn't have a choice. They have two young sons to support, and they still have mortgage payments to make.
I'd love to be going back for good, but I'd say we're going to be here for another few years anyway, until we get back on our feet.
And until Ireland gets back on its feet, too. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We'll get the U.S. unemployment figures for August tomorrow morning, and the actual numbers won't be as important as which way the labor market trend is going. But this we know right now, that the recession has been brutal for people who've already lost their jobs. A study from Rutgers University shows two-thirds of unemployed Americans say they're depressed, and that many of them now avoid social situations. That's exactly the opposite of what you need to do to find a new job, but if you've tried networking and sent out dozens or hundreds of resumes with no luck, there might be another option, as Cash Peters explains.
Hey, are you out of work? Tired of getting no response to your boring old resume? Then pay attention, because recruiting expert Mark Sadovnik has decided to help you.
Companies are being swarmed with resumes, so you gotta do something different.
You do. And you know what that something different is? According to him, anyway. ResBuzz.
ResBuzz.com is helping individuals, companies, and recruiters differentiate themselves with the power of video networking.
Yes. That's their promo video. Basically, ResBuzz is a website that allows
individuals to set themselves apart and effectively highlight their strongest attributes.
Exactly. By shooting a video resume with their webcam and posting it online. Or, if your strongest attribute is that you're plain lazy, then for around $500, ResBuzz will make the video for you.
Complete with professional sound and lighting.
Ooh, sound. Actually, the video resume is useful for potential employers too. It gives them the chance to pre-screen you and meet you ahead of time, without all the awkwardness that comes with not actually liking you when they do. Casey Eberhardt is a public speaker and one of their clients. He'll try anything to be successful.
My shtick is about the energy I bring to a room. If somebody sees me on a video, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to get what my personality is about.
Whatever happened to sleeping your way to the top?
Oh, I do that as well. That's why I'm at the top.
One downside of this service, if you ignore the obvious fact that some people are so shy and awkward on camera that they might actually wreck their chances of ever finding work, is that whereas before you might have been able to lie or exaggerate on your paper resume and kind of get away with it, with video, it's slightly trickier.
It is harder to lie on video. If I'm a recruiter, I would almost think that I'm finding out more about who the real person is than what their lies are going to be on the resume.
I've spent the past 2 years on the road traveling and really getting a lot of practical world experience.
This is one of their most recent video resumes.
I've done some travel writing in the past couple years, and I also have been involved in nonprofit work.
Yeah, you see? Already I'm bored. And that's the problem. I'd turn this off after 2 seconds. Catherine Gray is one of the company's directors.
There's something about telling it in your own story, in your own passion, in your own enthusiasm that makes it come alive that the paper resume cannot accomplish.
Yeah, you see, when I'm in the room being interviewed, you're not going to get rid of me until I've made my point. If I'm on video, they can just shut me off.
Well, it gives you a little bit more of an advantage, though, than that piece of paper.
Love is the most important value in my life, to love thy neighbor as thyself.
Oh, God. Hey, you know what would be even better than this? Dispense with the resume altogether, track down the boss you want to work for, and get FaceTime with them directly, in a bar, for instance. Mark Sadovnik likes this idea, while simultaneously thinking it's completely idealistic and stupid.
What's the chances that I'm going to meet Cash at the bar and get him to...
Actually, quite a lot, to be honest with you.
Oh, probably, okay. So what can you do? What can most people do? The 80, 90% of people that won't have the opportunity to meet somebody at the bar... You got to do something different to get noticed.
20 minutes in a sauna.
With whom?
Well, with your future employer.
Well, absolutely. If you can find that they're there, let's face it, the bottom line is relationship. Somehow you got to get in the door.
That's true. And maybe ResBuzz is one way to do that. After all,
it's the new digital recruitment platform for the 21st century.
Well, you know, probably. In Los Angeles.
I appreciate honesty, integrity.
Quick, where's the off switch? I'm Cash Peters from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it has been a rough couple of days for Google. First, their web-based email service Gmail was knocked offline for a couple of hours on Tuesday. Not the most promising performance from a company that more and more of us are using for almost everything. Then last night, their head chef got booted off a television reality show. Preeta Mistry was tossed from Bravo's Top Chef for an uninspired pasta salad. What sells to hungry high-tech workers apparently doesn't work so well with everybody, I guess. At least she's got a sense of humor. She told a blogger in San Francisco today she's working on some side projects, maybe a pasta salad cookbook. Who knows? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media, where, by the way, we have very nice vending machines. Today, the Dow rose 63 points, 6 tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 16 points, 8 tenths percent. The S&P 500 added 8 points, 8 tenths of 1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, satisfying America's love of sport.
Every town I pulled into, a cable operator would say to me, "You know, George, this is a sports town." And every town in America believes they're a sports town. And ESPN came along at a time to tap into that.
Another conversation from the corner office, this time with ESPN's George Bodenheimer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.